This is the EdGenius Podcast. The EdGenius Podcast brings you the tried, true, and proven of online education to help you provide a better learning experience for your students. I'm Rob Letcher, and on the EdGenius Podcast, I talk with teachers, students, and EdTech leaders about their online teaching and learning successes and failures, and what they've learned from both. I have a confession to make. While I taught several years online and spent 4 years teaching young adults at the Philadelphia Job Corps program, I quit my public school teaching gig after just 2 years, all but giving up on the teaching profession. When the topic comes up, I typically say I was the victim of burnout, but that's not entirely accurate. I left because I struggled with the drastic dichotomies I encountered. The public school system had too much structure in the parts that needed to be flexible, and not enough structure and support where it was needed. There was lots of professional development, but not much of it dealt with my realities in the classroom. I had all the flexibility in the world about how to teach, but had no supplies or curriculum, other than a single set of books for all of my sections to share that were 10 years old. 10-year-old science books. There was a no-nonsense administrator that was tough on kids, but offered no support to help them do better. In short, I was faced with a no-win situation, and so were my students. I left them, and have never stopped feeling guilty about that, even now, over 20 years later. But the reason I left them was not to abandon them, but to try and make it better. It was then that I decided to work to fix education, to provide alternatives for the kids and families for whom traditional schools weren't working, to do what I could do to make the system more flexible and supportive. And that led me into the online learning field, where I helped launch online schools all over the country that, to date, have served over 1 million students. My guest today shares a similar goal: to help schools and school systems perfect the last mile of learning by becoming more agile and resilient. Our EdGenius this week, Andrew Coe, has spent the last 25 years of his professional career developing a well-rounded set of skills, including sales, business development, consulting, accounting, and corporate restructuring for the top management consulting and technology companies in the world. His new company, Covexa, works to improve education with solutions and offerings using artificial intelligence and the creation of curriculum pathways for high-tech skills. His current clients include several of the largest universities, community college systems, K-12 districts, leading ed techs, venture capital and private equity organizations globally. Prior to launching Covexa, Andrew worked in various leadership roles at Amazon, Samsung Global Education, Microsoft, and has even worked politically, serving on Virginia's Board of Education. Andrew, thank you so much for being on the EdGenius Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Many people say that the American education system is broken. Do you agree?
Well, that's an interesting start of a question, Robert. I would say,
No softballs here, Andrew. You can handle that.
No, go straight to the point. Well, I would say, I wouldn't necessarily say broken is probably the exact words I would use, but there's clearly much to be improved. And as compared to many other countries, as well as other state systems in our union, there are a lot of good things that have happened. And there's clearly a lot of areas that obviously need some areas of improvement. Broken is very a tough word, but I would definitely say that the areas that I've seen, Rob, where I would say if we were to go a little bit deeper, where the areas really we've discovered to see a lot of challenges, especially during this particular time of remote learning, distance learning, hybrid learning, all the new words that have come out within the last 18 months. We've had a really incredible, set of circumstances. And I think we had 1.8 billion learners around the planet just at pretty much at once stopped learning. And now the last 18 months have been everything from picking up the pieces, really trying to be dynamic of creating an environment where educators, parents, and students have not learned this particular type of way of learning in a very, very fluid and agile fashion. And so there's a lot of reflections, a lot of questions. And I'd say if I were to point three areas, Robert, if some people were to say broken, or I would say areas to really much improve, is number one, I call it pathways or a curriculum. Hmm. Especially in the U.S., I think there's probably a lot of folks that are probably questioning, you know, the way our sequencing of our classes and what we're teaching, are they really relevant right now? And it's not to say that anyone are particularly bad, but I think a lot of us now have come to the realization that, you know, we do need a lot more modernization of the types of things that we teach that would really impact a lot of what our learners would be embracing and driving, particularly around skills. Not just skills of computer science, which I'm always an advocate for, that we need to have much more of those type of skills indoctrinated into our curriculum. Right. But also, I would even say soft skills, like presentations, working in an environment, a project-based learning environment. And I would say, if anything, those type of areas should be really looked at, not just for a grade, but even, you know, this emergence of micro-credentials probably needs to start making their way into the mainstream part of education.
Yeah, we don't hear that, right? Yeah. I think I'm seeing that develop in the post-secondary space, for sure, and in the professional learning space, but don't really see it, you know, very evident in the K-12 space yet.
Yeah, well, there's a couple, and it's not prevalent out there. Robert, I would say if you look at states like Utah or Nevada, and I believe Wyoming, there's a little company called Midas Education that actually work with the State Board of Education and have created micro-credentials. And I think I also even will pause and say, there's also a difference between micro-credential and badging. I think badgings are nice, but I consider them like our virtual gold stars. But micro-credentials, where this little company called Midas Education has really made big waves, has really worked with the state boards of education to not only have educator type of micro-credentials, right? Hey, how do I teach in Canvas or Desire to Learn or Schoology? Right. But also even more in depth of, hey, are these educators really attuned to detecting learning disabilities or certain things like that? But they're also using it with students and learners, especially in diverse communities where, as we know, even prior to the pandemic, the dropout rates were very high for a lot of, we'll call it disadvantaged, lower income communities. But the one main reason, I still remember a Bill Gates Foundation survey says, students don't really understand the value of education and how applicable it is to their life or to a job. And these micro-credentials, particular, I think what they were trying to do in Utah, were targeted with the Latinx community. And it was designed by a lot of companies as well as embraced by the State Department of Education. And it's phenomenal. What they're seeing is a lot more students that are in tune to it and can now relate to an actual skill, right?
Have you seen that movement into credentialing have an impact on what you call pathways, curriculum, and sequencing? Because what I'm imagining is you're looking at an accreditation like that or a competency and realizing, boy, there was a lot of stuff in my scope and sequence that I didn't really need. Is that something that you think is happening or will happen?
I think it will happen. And I say that the reason I correlate micro-credentials with pathways is, let's be honest, like the pathways today that we have from pre-K to K through 12 to post-secondary, it's all disconnected. And in some states, there's different governing bodies, different types of ways. And I think that micro-credentialing, the more valid it becomes, the more indoctrinated it becomes of a student's learning, they're going to start seeing the value of those. And as they start to get onto transcripts, and as soon as post-secondary institutions, companies start valuing that more than just your attendance and a letter grade, then I think you're going to start to see, hopefully, the unraveling of all these antiquated silos that we have, and hopefully a little bit more of a connected pathway in where skills and these credentials have a way to thrive versus sort of fall off a cliff
right.
every time they finish high school or community college or what.
Right.
But
so Pathways is your first. What's your second?
Yeah. Second is educated profession. I just say right now, we're losing teachers. And I think there's even one of the studies and articles came out, almost a quarter of our educators are contemplating or have already left the profession. And this pandemic has not been any easier on them as well as anybody else. And we really need to look at remodeling our educator, not just from a professional development, that's for sure, but even prior to becoming an educator in the pre-service world of colleges of education. I think it's also important to start redesigning that and understanding how that becomes a lot more of a lead-in with new educators coming in, also having a lot more of this now, you know, capabilities well beyond, we'll call it the traditional way of teaching and learning, and hopefully some new ways of leveraging technology and information to also improve the profession, but also hopefully, in my opinion, increase this profession. We need to make this profession as important as an emergency doctor or a police officer. And we got to really raise the bar. And whether it's through increased salaries or a certain type of benefits, we just need to really raise the bar for educators because they are really a lifeline to a good education system.
What I talk to a lot of, I talk to a lot of teachers, and what I hear from so many teachers, and I'm sure you've heard the same, and if you're on, you know, any social networks, you're hearing it, is that the problem is not so much that the teachers aren't themselves professional, but that they're not seen as professionals. How do you react to that kind of statement?
I agree. And I don't know where it is. And I've lived abroad, Robert. I've lived in South Korea, and I've witnessed even my own children. Now, they went to a private school because they couldn't speak Korean. But
well, I mean, that's no excuse, right? I mean, come on, they could.
Exactly. but I would say there's definitely a culture difference. And I'm not saying teachers in other countries are just so revered as much, but they are looked upon differently in certain countries for sure. There's definitely a professionalism that is embraced by the parents, and there's a certain level of respect, I would say. I can't, you know, I haven't seen a study or an exact quantitative way, but having lived in other countries, having visited many, many other systems, that's for sure. And in the U.S., I don't know what the right answer is, Robert, but I would say it's hard and it is somewhat different. I feel that some people think the educators is an easy profession.
Right.
And I think somewhere from there, we need to realize it's not. And I hope that this past pandemic has realized for a lot of the parents who had to be with their own child and their learn in the home, hopefully have come to that same conclusion that it's not so easy as what you think it is. Maybe that is part of the beginning as well.
So you mentioned that you'd like to see, or you feel that we need to see a remodeling of that educator preparation. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned technology as a part of that. Do you have some examples of what you sort of foresee this new teaching, this new teacher looking like? Well, how would I know this new teacher when I see one in the wild?
Yeah, and I would say, and I'm going to speak in more generalities because clearly every college of education has different type of curriculum and different standards out there for sure. But from what I observe is there hasn't been a lot of standards when it comes to the use of technology or the use of information from those technologies. So it's not less, so it's not so much, hey, I just know how to teach in a particular tool, but are there different pedagogies that I should understand and embrace when I'm teaching someone online in a digital remote environment versus face-to-face? Or what do we do with, you know, and so are there classes, are there courses, are there best practices? Are there methods and time when they're doing some of those pre-service and they're during their education years to work in some of the systems while they're having that so that they can start testing some of those particular new different ways of teaching and learning and start crafting a lot more of those, we'll call it techniques, if you will, and to realize that technology is a core fabric of teaching and learning. And I'm not sure if there's an exact class, probably a multitude of classes. I would say that's definitely one of those particular areas I think we need to start embracing
more. Yeah, and I think it's interesting because when you said there's not an exact class, maybe a single class, I would agree with that. It's certainly more complicated than this, right? But we wouldn't have a class on how to teach with a whiteboard versus a chalkboard. Right. We wouldn't have a class on how to teach with chalk versus wipe off markers. And when we start thinking about, again, of course, they're more complex. There's more complexity to the tools that are available to teachers and the resources. But in the end, what we're really talking about is I've always felt that good teaching is good teaching. What that looks like can change radically given the setting you're put in and the tools that are available to you. I agree with you. I think, you know, putting someone in a sandbox, someone who's comfortable saying, I think of it as Lego sets, right? Someone who's comfortable taking different parts of Lego sets and assembling them into something new is, I think, sort of a key skill there.
Yeah. And I would even kind of lead to my even third point. But if you take a step back, Robert, and just look at what we've just experienced. And I've worked with major districts along the way to resolve some of the biggest challenges that were occurring the last 12 months. And the common thing that I found is how do educators know what's happening on the other side of that device or that monitor? You know, how are they understanding how students are engaging or not? The one thing that I felt that everyone understood was trying to solve that problem was through just measuring logins. And that was now not just because that was the only way to look at engagement. I mean, there's clearly timesheets and attendance and all that, but login data. And Robert, so my analogy was that's not the right way to understand student engagement. And when you take a step back and look, well, if this learner was in their classroom, their respective educator's classroom, you see their behavior. You see that they're attentive. They're engaging. They're raising their hands or not doing homework or doing well on assessments or not. All that was gone. All that physical proximity of understanding, engaging, or determining how the students were engaging was gone. And so it was extremely challenging to see that. And that's, you know, and then applying the same ways of taking the assessments and all that, we're seeing just a tremendous learning loss. And the frustration was it's not that the educators didn't want to help. They didn't know what tools were out there to help them mitigate that. They didn't know what other information that they should be collecting. If you look at all the departments of data, research, and instruction, you ask them, okay, if you step back, what information do you need? Often they don't know.
Yes.
They don't know what they're looking for. Because it's not no longer just structured information.
Well, and I would also argue that some of that has to go with expectations from governing bodies. So in my years of experience in online public charter schools, the measurement of purely attendance makes no sense. A, it made no sense in light of the model we were using or attempting to use. And worse, B, it forced us to align our model to an antiquated model simply because we had no other way around the legal aspects of counting meat in the seats for X number of minutes a day or hours.
Right. And that's exactly right. And I think in this digital world, I always say that, you know, it's super important to understand what's going on the other side. And let's take another analogy that I use that I'll try to make it a little bit more politically correct. If I turn on the lights in my restroom, but I walk out and forget to turn it off, it doesn't mean I was in the bathroom for 8 hours. You know, and that's unfortunately what a lot of the districts are. And they know that too. Right. The other thing is they're not ignorant people. They know that. But there were no other ways. There are no other ways. And this is the type of things, I think, not just from a profession, but just the science of learning is probably going to be reflected upon greatly. I think a lot of the standardized examinations and assessments and the tremendous weight we put on them, right? PISA, SAT, you know, even a grade letter A, what does that really mean? Because an A in one class by one educator may be an A minus or a B in another one. So it's never really been equal from day one. And I think going back to your point of, what did you call it? Mead and seat.
Yeah.
I would say we've reflected on, I call it this sort of tectonic shift that's happening between time-based learning versus degree-driven learning versus skills-based. And the degree part is even people are questioning universities, post-secondary. Why am I really paying whatever, $70,000, $80,000 for this degree that I'm learning online? Is that really worth it? And if you, and going even outside of primary and secondary, if you look at post-secondary, they're going through a tremendous amount of evolution as well.
The reality is, again, I think the science of, I think, legislation and mm-hmm. governing bodies need to catch up with the science of learning. Mm-hmm. As educators, we absolutely do as well. But when we're governed by bodies that don't recognize the science of learning as fundamental to their guidelines, then I think we have a huge mm-hmm. problem on our hands that no one wins at, right? No, you can never win, because you can never be successful when you're being asked to measure the wrong thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's got to change. So we'll wait and see how that evolves. And as you said, everything is really tethered together. And that's what makes education so complicated, especially in the United States, where we have a very decentralized system of our education system, our public education system. And it's very much locale or local driven, but with very somewhat stringent federal guidance and state guidance. And until somebody looks at the system holistically, I think it's going to continue this way, or there's going to be very much rough shifts in the waves of right now as we're starting to look at education and how to redesign them.
Speaking of shift, I want to shift to a slightly different topic, but related. Let's talk about data. I know that you're very passionate about data and its relationship to learning. What role do you think data plays in the modern learning system as it's evolving?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll just say, for a lot of the listeners to your podcast, my background has been 25 years within the technology companies. And what I've come to realize is that this gig economy, for lack of a better word, that includes education. I always say that data is the new currency, and we are now the product. You know, we're beyond the Industrial Revolution and all those. We truly have a tremendous amount of convergence of information, systems, data. And even IBM at one point said that, you know, 90% of the world's data was created in the last 2 years. And that little statement was like about 5-6 years ago. And I would even argue that probably is true today. And so we are seeing already the rise of data increase. And we should expect it to only go further with the introduction of IoT, 5G. The world's going to get much more connected. And what just happened was that we just hopefully enabled a great majority of our learners on this planet with devices, so much that we actually had a device shortage on the planet. People don't even realize there's actually still a shortage of a lot of chips and all the devices out there. But I also look back, and I think hopefully if I really simplified it, I always say that if Facebook or some social media can tell and recommend that I want a hamburger before I'm even hungry and be pretty accurate, why can't we leverage that type of power of that information and turn it not for anything nefarious, but to improve education? And that's the sort of the area where I say modernizing learning can happen. And there's definitely, I'll say, like three ways that I think I'd love to make sure that your listeners hear of what I even see is even the device and the connectivity. While we still struggle with the challenge of connectivity, just imagine all the tons of information as a user, where they're clicking, where they're searching to fulfill that assessment answer. Are they going to Khan Academy? Are they going to YouTube? Are they really using that curriculum, content that our district purchased? You know, what apps are they using? In some districts, they've counted over 5,000 different apps that are being used. And that can be scary, but that can be positive, right? And so that alone, the connectivity, the devices, the patterns, the behavior, I think we start to now look at the whole child. And this is another big word out there. And when we have to look at the data that arises, it's no longer just the structured data, and to just explain structured data, your test. You know, it's structured data is your attendance, your grades, you know, what social activities are you involved in? Unstructured data or whole child type of thing is, what's the environment of that learner in their Wi-Fi environment? Is their speed 100 megabytes or gigahertz or better? You know, do they have a sibling in the household? There are certain studies, informal, non-research studies, that, and it's common sense, that having an older sibling while remote learning, actually you have an advantage. And then you think about that, it's because they're perhaps there to know how to reset a Wi-Fi.
Right.
Or help turn on the printer, little things like that that we have yet to discover. And as you know, I don't think it's uncommon to say that we have seen a tremendous amount of student anxiety. And this whole world of social emotional learning has taken on another level of I call it importance. We're seeing a lot of unfortunate things happen, Robert. A lot of it's not hitting the news, but I would say for at least two of the largest districts that I've consulted for are seeing a lot of students hurting themselves. One university, a very prominent one that I can't disclose this research, did a several in-depth surveys and polls with their student body and discovered that the students are the most disconnected and the most quote-unquote lonely or self-isolated when they're on a video learning lecture.
Interesting.
Yeah. So how do we need to take all that data, all the positive things and all those patterns to either help the educators learn or even be alerted to certain situations that may be happening in real time. And I think we can do that. Yeah. And I would even say, I haven't seen a lot of the research, but I'm sure there are many out there, that this has even disproportionately affected our diversity of our communities, the Black, Brown children, and kids with special needs. It has been extremely hard for kids with special needs to learn distance learning, remote learning. Technology also is not necessarily fully there for all of those, even though there are definitely a lot of workarounds.
Right.
But even our educators, I mean, it's a very different world and very challenging for the household, the learner, and for the educator. And so those are things that we have yet to solve those. But I believe, Robert, data is going to be the way we're going to resolve it. The anecdotes are good, but we're going to have to go back to really the science of learning, the data, what is it telling us? And knowing that as every learner is different, there is no cookie cutter to it. Like, it's going to have to be very, very individualized,
right,
of how we look at education.
Right. Otherwise, it's akin to teaching with your eyes closed in a physical, right, classroom. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't ignore, right, a student's performance on a test. Those are all data points. When I talk to teachers who have made this transition to online learning as a result of COVID and just of their, mm-hmm, own volition, I hear all the time, it's so weird because I didn't realize how much I relied on body language and their facial, mm-hmm, expressions. Right. And to your point, that there is data, it's certainly different data, but there is data available that if we, mm-hmm, are tracking the right data, if we're mining the right data, if we're evaluating and analyzing it, and more importantly, making it accessible to the teacher, yes, in a usable manner, mm-hmm, it's there. We just need to make, right, it important. So speaking of, it's a little bit of a cliche to say, you know, disruption in ed tech, right? Because everyone wants to be the disruptor. But COVID really has been the disruptor in education, I think.
Yep.
So what needs to change other than another, God forbid, another pandemic? What needs to change in order for schools and school systems to serve students better?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'd say, just from my own personal observation, and as I stated earlier, I was called in usually when there's a couple things. Number one, when there's a big problem happening at school district, I usually get the phone call. Or number two, what I would say is, when there's certain leaders that want to now look forward. So they're not no longer just trying to keep their head above water, which I feel like has been 99% of the case, which is absolutely normal. Everyone's just trying to figure out, because there's no playbook of how to say, oh, how do we teach in class one day and then tomorrow we're going to go all online, because that's kind of what happened. But I would say, number one, the most important thing is the leader. I believe the leader brings, he or she, superintendent, school board, it could be principals, not just any one leader, but all of them collectively, really is one of the most important aspects of how I would say needs to change the mentality of understanding what we just went through, and not just to stay afloat and just keep up with the Joneses, but let's take this opportunity to now really improve and leapfrog into another method of improving education overall. Another one, and then, and it just begins and ends with that. I mean, that's quite frankly, it's not a new technology you buy or another LMS or video. Quite frankly, they're all irrelevant, but the leadership is important, because the second thing is the culture and tone that he or she sets or those leaders set. There's a lot of political things that have to occur, bad or good. And that's unfortunate, unfortunate in both circumstances.
It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, right? If the policies from the top down are stifling innovation and not growing and evolving with the science of learning, then you're always going to have the proverbial glass ceiling.
Absolutely. The also one is the culture around the parents and the community. Right now, as we are all hopefully getting vaccinated in the U.S., and I respect the ones that are not for their own right reasons. That's a whole different podcast for you, I'm sure. But it's almost a 50-50 split.
Right.
To look at many of the surveys, half the parents want their learners, their students and child to go back to school. The other half, no. Educators, it's actually balanced almost no, but that seems to be changing around 50-50. So it's a dead even thing. And so there's no perfected answer. But overall, it just the leaders, and they set the tone of this being a crazy food fight. Or, hey, we're just going to do this and we're going to move forward in a very positive way and we're going to do our best. I'd say third thing is the IT systems, and that's my bias of the technology side, has to be right. We all know, Robert, I don't know what your experience is, but my experience, and I've looked at many IT systems from the biggest to the smallest to the ones in urban schools to even the ones in rural, majority, we got to go to the cloud. And I don't work for any of the cloud companies any longer. But there's no excuse, zero, to say that certain systems should not belong there. Why? I believe that type of functionality is not necessarily needed in schools. Outsource it, get it out to these companies who know how to run a 24/7 system and make it run just as beautifully as your Netflix or your Xfinity or your Comcast systems are out there. Let it work for schools as well.
So what about budget? Is this going to blow the budget for districts?
No, actually, a lot of the studies that I've done two of these type of reviews, even the last 12 months, one very large and one just sort of, well, they're both large districts. You actually can save money and save overall total cost. And more importantly, money saving, but you get to reallocate the personnel who may have been, I don't know, updating that database server, patch fixing it at 2 a.m. Like, who really wants to do that? But, you know, some people fear that, hey, if that goes away, I won't have a job. No, no, no. If you go to the cloud and move a lot into a much more resilient, cost-afforded type of hosted environment, for lack of a better word, where we find the smart districts or smart institutions, because it's happening in higher ed as well, is they allow for those individuals who are doing those system patch fixes to be much more facing toward the educators. What do the educators need? What applications do they need to drive? How can they improve call centers, other areas that might have spiked up? Because we got a lot of phone calls coming in, not just from students, for teachers and administrators anymore. They're coming from students, the uncles, the parents. Hey, my nephew or daughter's, you know, app disappeared or deleted. And I mean, there's a lot of those phone calls that have been increasing exponentially. So I would say there's refactoring to consider. But I think you can ultimately save money, but also time. And I think time is something that we don't measure enough, and how valuable that time is for an educator, for a principal. That is probably one of the most greatest assets that we don't get back, even if it costs a dollar more or a dollar less. And that's the kind of productivity I think we need to help with technology that can really make, hopefully, a life a little bit easier in some instances, for sure. For sure.
So we're hopefully coming into the tail end of the pandemic. this pandemic forced us all into our own homes, or, you know, these cloistered learning centers like they had in Philly and in other places, moved everyone into online learning almost all at once, or almost all. What long-lasting impact do you hope this experience will bring to the larger field of education?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say from a long-lasting experience, impression, or scar tissue, who knows what it, you know, everyone has their own sort of experiences.
See this one right here? See this one right here? I got this one teaching online in 2021.
That's right. We're going to cover it up with a tattoo. Right, I survived the pandemic. But to me, I would say my biggest fear is that we're going to go back the way we were before. That's my greatest fear. I love the word silver lining, Robert, because as painful and challenging it is for most people, and it still is for individuals and families, and it's not to make up any of the learning loss that have happened to so many of our students right now, but we can't go back. Not only should we not go back, we need to even go further and make those structural changes, those design changes, those policy changes that need to happen, because it's not just about us in our local school, in our local district. This is a worldwide overall challenge. And knowing what other countries are doing, they all now recognize we've been sort of leveled. We all have been flattened by this pandemic. Everybody stopped and they're all revving back up, just like the economy. Now, which one's going to figure it out to maximize their learning for their learners and improving their education system? That's the conversation that's happening. So for those that want to go back, we just got to go back the way it was before and everything will be fine. I would say I would just pause before we really think that that is the right thing to do. Or do we take this and really learn from it, appreciate the challenges we've had, not fall back into some of the same problems we have, and even exponentially step up and improve it to a degree that we will never look back. Another one is just, I hope people learn, because I know when the pandemic first hit, it was just a mad rush to your local device store or calling the orders from all the digital learning is more than buying a device and having access. Yes, there are absolute gaps that we have in our community across the board. That has been, broadband is not everywhere as it should be, for sure. And we need to do that. But I think people, as what you even said, whether it's the educator or even parents, need to know that the applications, the types of content, the way we teach is also could be very slightly different. We're not going to always be shackled by this 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. lesson plans anymore. You know, do we really need all that extra time in between, or can we repurpose some of the time that we have into other areas? And that would be a very bigger way to think than just buying a device and access and thinking that that's going to take care of itself. The other real long-lasting area is I really hope the community wants to, again, kind of sound like a backwards or another record, a broken record, but we got to invest back in our educators, the system as well. I don't know how many board meetings, school board meetings have you attended, Rob, but not many people have. I would say almost, if I were to guess, 95% of people probably have never attended a school board meeting unless there was a rezoning or something was happening that was controversial at the time. But often the school board members, they need your input. There's a lot of big decisions when it comes to budgets and where they spend it. And we need to be very vigilant as parents and as community leaders to partake in those, knowing we just learn, knowing that even IT should not be one of those things. We don't need that now because we'll get caught off guard. And the worst thing that could happen is that another pandemic or another incident, and we are left in a similar position and have not improved at all. So really bringing the community to be aware of it. And the final thing is, I think it has exposed this digital divide greatly, and how closely tethered that is with the divide of the equity issue. There's many school districts that I witnessed certain parents and communities and students not coming forward to let people know they had a device or not because they had a lot of fear of reporting themselves because of whatever, certain personal issues or certain you know, we'll call it citizenship issues. And again, not to be political in this call, but that was a reality, what I saw. And those students, we've lost for the whole year, unfortunately. We don't know where they are. We don't even know where they are. And that is a shame. And I would say education needs to be for all. And we got to really raise the tide for everybody equally.
Agreed. So at the end of the podcast, which is where we find ourselves now, I ask my resident ed genius for the call, what are some hints, tips, tricks, advice you'd like to give either teachers, parents, administrators, ed tech companies? You have clear reign. Any pieces of advice or suggestions or recommendations you want to make? Now's a good time.
I would say, if I were to say one overall embracing thing is learning is lifelong. Even myself at the age of 50, I'm always learning new things. I thought I knew a lot of things. And this pandemic, especially in this world of education, has taught me an incredible amount of new ideas. So never stop learning. They always look around and find and discover who are, or which systems or which individuals or which educators are doing things right. Pick up on those. There is no one set path that we have. So I think we just need to keep our aperture much more wide open, be open to new experiment, new ideas. I've come from very trillion-dollar market capitalization companies, and people always want to go, well, how did these companies that you used to work for innovate? And oh, this great technology. Culture. It was what was embodied to us. We had to innovate, and we need to keep that same type of mentality, curiosity, and conviction and measure ways to measure in the education. That's all of us, whether you're a parent, whether you're an ed tech, an educator, principal, or superintendent, always look for those improvements and innovative ways of thinking and try. It's okay to fail. We teach our kids it's okay to fail. And we as adults need to go down that same pathway and not just fall into the trap of the bureaucracy.
Hmm. Very good. Well, Andrew, I can't say thank you enough for taking your valuable time to spend with me and the listeners of the iGenius podcast. Grateful beyond words.
Well, thank you very much. And it's been my pleasure. I appreciate the time.
Our iGenius this week, Andrew Coe, founder of Covexa. So what did we learn in this episode? A lot. Improving the American education system involves developing skill-focused pathways and credentialing. Andrew feels that there needs to be a redesigning of the teaching profession that elevates them to the roles of physicians and other professionals, and that data is the new currency in education, and we need to look at data about the whole child, not just logins. To get the changes we need to focus on hiring leaders with innovative mindsets, developing a culture that supports the whole student, and having IT systems that are right and rich and in the cloud. And what we've learned from COVID is we can't and shouldn't go back to normal. We should use what we learn to maximize learning for all students. That's all the time we have for this episode of EdGenius. Once again, thanks to Andrew Coe, founder of Covexa, for being our EdGenius this week. And of course, thanks to Crowinder, whose song Funhouse you heard at the beginning of this episode and now again. I'll leave you with the immortal words of Ben Franklin, who said, "An investment in knowledge pays the best interest." Thanks for listening.